Welcome to Building Great Leaders with Dr. Les Olala.
But I think a biblical leader is one who will set the pattern, first of all, that I am willing to get in the trench, I am willing to serve, I am willing to do everything that I can to help you.
On today's program, Dr. Olala focuses our attention on what the scripture says about the happy servant. This message was recorded at a chapel service in 2002. Building Great Leaders provides instruction, encouragement, and resources for Christian leaders. You can learn more at bgleaders.org, bgleaders.org. Our speaker, Dr. Les Olala, is the founder and director of Building Great Leaders and has been serving the Lord in full-time ministry for 50 years as a pastor, Bible college president, and evangelist. And now, the happy servant.
Let's turn to 1 Kings chapter 10. We find the story of Solomon and the Queen of Sheba. When we look at that whole concept and that whole idea, we find quite a, to me, a very interesting story. I was reading through my read through the Bible plan, and as you go through reading in these passages, sometimes you have a tendency to whiz through what is so-called familiar territory to you. But oftentimes we get stopped in the some thoughts. And we'll start reading in verse 1 of chapter 10. And when the Queen of Sheba heard of the fame of Solomon concerning the name of the Lord, she came to prove him with hard questions. She came to Jerusalem with a very great train, with camels that bear spices, very much gold, precious stones. And when she was come to Solomon, she communed with him of all that was in her heart. And Solomon told her all the questions. There was not anything hid from the king which he told her not. And when the Queen of Sheba had seen all the wisdom of Solomon and the house that he had built, the meat of his tables, the sitting of his servants, the attendance of his ministers, and their apparel, and his cupbearers, and his ascent by which he went up to the house of the Lord, there was no more spirit in her. And she said to the king, "It was a true report that I heard in mine own land of thy acts and of thy wisdom. Howbeit I believed not the words until I came, and mine eyes had seen it, and behold, a half was not told me. Thy wisdom and thy prosperity exceedeth the fame which I heard." This woman was overwhelmed. I think she loaded up. She had heard of this country bumpkin called Solomon. And she thought, "I'm going to go and show this so-called wise rich man what is real class." I don't know any other reason why she would have loaded up so much with a great train with camels and spices and gold and precious stones. Then she said, "I'm going to ask him some hard questions, and I'll see what he's really made of." Well, she sees what he has, and I think when she pulled up with her little camel train and she saw what Solomon had, she told her men, "Hide this behind maintenance, I'm embarrassed." I think she was taken aback very quickly by what was seen there. But I don't think that is what stood out in her mind as much as the next phrase in verse 8. "Happy are thy men. Happy are these thy servants." Happy servants, an oxymoron. All of these words, these world leaders had servants, but I can guarantee you they were not happy campers. The mentality of leadership determines the atmosphere of that work. You could go into a place where there were people working as slaves, servants, and you could sense very quickly the atmosphere that is there. Well, this queen came and saw everything that he had, but I think she was mind-boggled by the fact that they were happy. How can you have slave and happy in the same context? How does that happen? I think if you read Proverbs and you read a lot of the heart of Solomon, I think Solomon started out with a very humble mentality. when he was given the opportunity to have anything that he wanted in life, what did he ask? God, all I want is wisdom to know how to go out and come in before these people, because I have an assignment before me that's impossible. There was a humble attitude, a mentality that was so expressive of dependence on God. Well, this woman got an eyeful, and I think she got a heartful. Happy are thy men, happy are these thy servants which stand continually before thee and that hear thy wisdom. Blessed be the Lord thy God which delighted in thee to set thee on the throne of Israel. Because the Lord loved Israel forever, therefore made he thee king to do judgment and justice. Ultimately, when she saw what was happening, to whom did she attribute the glory? She said, "You're God." That's what she had heard. I don't know what the spiritual condition was of this Queen of Sheba, but I know that she saw the hand of God on the life of a man. If you ever studied the meals that were fed, how many animals had to be slain? How many sacrifices had to be made on the part of these people to get this work done? Now the question is, how does that happen? I read on, and that phrase jumped at me in verse 8. I thought, well, that's interesting. Happy are thy men. So I noted that in my mind. That's why you listen, you sit, you read, you pause, and then write. I always write. I always have a legal pad, or I'll have my manna, and I'll jot down things that are significant. Well, I jotted that down. And then I got into chapter 12, and I was reading, and obviously by then the kingdom had split. Jeroboam and Rehoboam had taken one the north and one the south. And then we find the career of Rehoboam, and as he became king of his segment. And then we pick up in chapter 12 and verse 6, and King Rehoboam consulted with the old men that stood before Solomon his father while he yet lived. And he said, "How do ye advise that I may answer this people?" So Rehoboam says, "I wonder how I should lead. What should I do? I know what I'll do. I'll ask the men who worked for my dad. And I'll ask these older men who are still around who were on my dad's staff. And I'm going to ask him, how do you recommend that I lead?" And I think in the next two verses, we find the success or the failure of a ministry. What made Solomon to have happy servants? Rehoboam gets these old men. These old men start telling about the old days. You know, I think a lot of times kids weary of us talking about the old days, but I think sometimes kids enjoy us talking about the old days. This generation cannot relate to toughness of the old days. I mean, they could not imagine it. There's no video game that could picture it. If you haven't lived it, there is no way, unless you go to Haiti, you're not going to understand what was going on in the United States before this successful lifestyle came into play. And so he went to the old timers, and I'm sure the old timers sat around, as old timers are wont to do, talking about these old times and old things. You remember when's? They said, "Well, Rehoboam, we'll give you some advice." And they spake unto him in verse 7, saying, "If thou wilt be a servant unto this people this day." So key number one, if you will be a servant, the key is servitude. We have rooted in our basic operative philosophy the whole mentality of servant leadership. The greatest leader who ever walked the face of this earth was the Lord Jesus Christ himself. And he said, "I did not come to be served, but I came to serve. Who would be greatest among you? Let him be servant of all." He says, with the world, this is how it is. A biblical leader is not one who has a handle on everything and all he has to do is snap a finger and people jump. But I think a biblical leader is one who will set the pattern, first of all, that I am willing to get in the trench, I am willing to serve, I am willing to do everything that I can to help you. That's why I think we need to start first and foremost. Our biblical mentality for leadership has to come out of these scriptures. We are all to exercise the gift of a servant mentality. We are all to exercise that realm of a servant mentality. So he said, if you will be a servant unto them, how important is that? What kind of an attitude does that reflect? It reflects a humble attitude. It reflects a humble mentality that has to be prominent in our lives. You look at Solomon, I think he is still on record probably as the richest and the wisest. Obviously, there were times what he tolerated. As I said yesterday, a direction is not determined by what you teach. Solomon taught some great stuff. It's what he tolerated. God said, don't tolerate multiplying horses. Don't tolerate these hussies that come in. But what did he do? The horses he multiplied and the women he multiplied. But the mentality that drove him internally was a mentality that our mission is going to happen to God's purpose, to God's glory. It is going to be by God's wisdom. And God, if you will only give me wisdom, that's all that I am asking. Does that not go along with 2 Corinthians chapter 12, where Paul says, I seek not mine own. He says, I will gladly spend. I'll give you my things and be spent. I will give you myself, knowing the more I do that, the less I will be loved. What a mentality that Paul manifested, that mentality. When you read the Corinthian letters, we see that there was the heart of Paul manifested in that, and the true heart of Paul in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, when you see what really made Paul tick. 1 Thessalonians chapter 2 will open up Paul's heart, lay his heart wide open in the defense of his ministry to people who were accusing him of being an eloquator and in it for himself. He opens his heart almost by force, and you find out what is really making Paul tick. He peels off the layers that had been covered by responsibilities, and in the defense of himself for the cause of Christ, you see what is going on in his heart. And this cannot be a pretense. It has to flow out of the heart. If you will be a servant unto them. Why is it so crucial? Because we have to be very vitally involved in the lives of people. Philippians chapter 2 obviously would be the master text on this, the self-emptying of Christ. On another workshop this week, I may touch on another portion of this. But in Philippians chapter 2, we see the whole aspect of the heart of Christ. And down here, before I close, I will go through characteristics of a humble person from Philippians chapter 2, because that is the driving mentality. And then number 2, verse 7, if thou wilt be a servant unto this people, and wilt serve them, and answer them. If you will answer these people, or share yourself with them. Sometimes the hardest thing you can do in ministry is answer people. Ever get in a situation sometimes where you see someone coming, you just want to hide because you're tired of answering? Because it demands sharing of yourself. So the key thought here is share yourself with people. Make yourself available. People have questions in their hearts. They have answers they need, answers that they really want in the things that they have to get done in life. And to do that, you have to be visible to share yourself and visible to answer the needs that are going on in the heart. I think all of us ought to be making availability tours. That's how we find out what's going on in the hearts of people. I will show up a lot of times in the rec hall, in the coffee shop, in the dining hall, not because I really have nothing else to do. I am making, I call these my availability tours, to see if anything is on anybody's heart who needs to grab me by the arm real quick and get an answer to something, or to have something where they don't feel like, if I'm going to ever talk to Doc, oh, I'm going to have to go through this echelon of people. One guy last summer said, he said, I really need to talk to him. I said, well, I was standing right by you. He said, well, I thought I needed an appointment. I said, what's wrong with you? So why do you think I'm visible? I said, grab me. I said, if I'll be honest with you, if I don't have time to mess with you right now, I'll tell you, I don't have time to mess with you right now. If I'm going to be a communicator of truth, I am also going to have to take the Philippians 2 mentality, and I have to be visible to touch people. If anyone could have just dictated from a cloud, it would have been the Lord Jesus Christ. But where do we find him? Right in the trench. We're real hurting people. We're real having real needs. You say, well, if I do that, then I'm not going to have anything to say. Then don't say anything then, if that is the mentality. Share yourself with people. And that means I'm going to have to break myself sometimes out of my little cell, or break myself out of my little mentality. And we can put projects. I would suggest that you put a project to this. Okay, how can I do this? How do I serve? How do I share? Well, I think, I was telling Charlene the other day, I said, you know, we need to take so-and-so out to supper, because that person is a behind-the-scene person, and I don't think gets a lot of attention other than just working and working and working. And I said, a blessing, a total blessing to me, watching how this person works. But take her to supper. I remember Dr. Jacot and I, a few years back, we were talking about starting taking departments. So Harold and I and Dr. Quo and some of us had talked about taking some of these departments to supper. And we were going to take the English department first, because they were under the greatest pressure at that time. And, you know, you could do little things. And many of you are masters at this. Little notes, a little box, a candy bar, a Snickers. And it doesn't take a lot to communicate that I am thinking of you and I am grateful for what you do. Tiny little things that communicate volumes. As I mentioned the other day, maybe it's $5 and a note. And you say, you know what, that person didn't have to do that. But you know what it is? It's making us get outside of ourselves, and we start thinking outside of our little frame of reference and outside of our little box. It is a crucial time to have these things built into us. So you serve them and answer them. How does a mission happen? A mission is stated. How does that mission statement happen? It happens through the hiring of personnel. So we hire people. So what has to be guarded? Relationships have to be guarded. Because if our mission is going to happen, it is going to happen through people. And it is going to happen through people who have a right relationship with God, and it happens through people who have a right relationship with each other. If there's any target at all to ruin what is happening missionally, it will be what will happen relationally. The stress and the suspicions and the things that come. And it is important. It is not something that automatically happens. Because when we are born full of self. And that we are not automatically given to giving ourselves to other people. We are not automatically geared to having others as our main thought. And so let's say that we start getting, I call it testy. We start getting testy with each other. And suddenly little conflicts arise. That's why you need to learn how to be gracious. Think of others. Don't be a snob. I read something quite interesting in a paper a couple weeks ago. It's called Feeling Superior. There are two snobs that are mentioned in here. And snobbery does not end with the social register, is the premise of this writer. Says essayist and Northwestern University English professor Joseph Epstein, who dishes out this little analyzed side of human nature in his new book, Snobbery, the American Version. Snob factors used to rank one status are found everywhere, down to what TV shows you, what to watch, pay cable, etc., etc. So what kind of snobs are there? There are three basic kinds. There's the downward-looking snob. That is one who comes and kind of has a downward look. And they take pleasure in a put-down. Then there's a fawning snob who wants to rise to a better world. He's not a snob yet, but he's heading that way. And then here's the most subtle snob of all. It's the reversed snobbery. It's called reverse snobbery. And this is what, in our financial category, this is the only kind of snobbery that we can really have. And I thought it was really interesting because it touches something I've noticed for years and years and years. How does reverse snobbery work? You wouldn't touch anything that other people have or are doing. So you ignore it. I have a sauna, for example. I will not ask anybody to go sauna because I don't want them to have the privilege of practicing reverse snobbery on me. Well, I really don't like that. Hey, well, I'll tell you what, if you want to get healed, a Finn's form of worship. Well, I'm not going to force that on anybody. I said worship, not worship. But a reverse snob is one who, well, so-and-so speaking, I'm just going to make arrangements not to be there. He may be speaking, but he doesn't have to know that I am there to hear him speak. Or Kelly has a snowmobile. Well, I don't really like snowmobiling. The opposite of that is being gracious. Hey, snowmobile. Hey, I've never ridden one, but give me a ride. I'll run my rosary beads hot. I've never been on one. But hey, a gracious person expresses a desire to, hey, I want to show interest in what you have. Everybody has a certain knowledge of something that somebody else doesn't have. A gracious person would express interest in that. A snob, broke as flat as a pancake. This kind of snobbery is what control freaks practice. This is the subtle kind. I thought that was really interesting. And then he goes through warning signs, and then how can you snob-proof yourself? That was just some tremendous truth there. But you know what? Sometimes the snobbery is the biggest hindrance to relationships on our level. But it's not snobbery. It's the reverse snobbery, because you don't have anything to snob over. Tiny little things that can happen. Relationships. We have to maintain these. Make sure you don't pillow your head at night with an unsettled conflict. Just make sure. And then what happens when relationships break, trust breaks. And all of a sudden there is a suspicion. And the minute a person no longer feels trusted, you have lost the base of your mission. You know why? Because a mistrust loses the mutual respect and the mutual appreciation, which is what makes a happy servant mentality, is the whole mentality of mutual appreciation. I appreciate what you do so much. I don't suspicion you. What are you doing? But I mutually appreciate you, which comes out of mutual respect, which comes out of trust, which comes out of right relationships, so that our mission can happen. And I did this a couple years back with the group of leaders and department heads to make sure that we keep, if our mission is going to happen, the minute we lose this, a cloud comes over this area, then you might as well X out the mission, because the whole atmosphere then becomes an atmosphere of accusation, an atmosphere of suspicion. And when that begins to happen, forget this happy servant mentality. It's just not going to be there, because there is going to be fostering hurt. There is going to be the whole aspect of things that are going to cause us to not to want to do. You want to know what will kill motivation quicker than anything else? It's the fact I'm not trusted. Okay? That's how they want it. They don't understand the hours I put in. They don't understand the contacts I've made. They don't understand so-and-so. They don't understand such-and-such. And we have to operate on a much bigger world. But we go back now, and I have to close, to the third aspect. You serve them, servitude, answer them, sharing yourself, if you will speak good words unto them. So the key here is speech or words. If you will speak good words unto them. It doesn't cost you a dime to say a kind word, to say an encouraging word. Thank you. I appreciate that. I don't know that I say kind words often enough. I think you need to say kind words to those who have to travel a lot. You say, what? He's gone again? Well, who do you think is going to be preaching in the camps? Now, we do have an option to just stay cloistered here in the North Woods and pray and don't let anybody go out. Pray for those who have to live on airplanes. Pray for those who have to speak. There's nothing enjoyable about sleeping in a camp bunk. Nothing enjoyable about the constant feeding on camp food. As good as camp food can be, there's nothing that'll replace mama's meal. And the last thing we want those who have to be out there to feel when they get back is mistrust. Those of you who don't judge what a person is doing, you say, well, where is he going with those golf clubs? Well, the same guy going out those golf clubs at 11 in the morning just left the office at 3 o'clock in the morning after a 17-hour day. So don't think just because he is going out while you are in, you're putting in your 8-hour shift or 12-hour shift or whatever it may be, don't automatically have a suspicion. Why don't you just say a word of encouragement? Thank you so much for hard work you've done. You've done a tremendous job. Thank you so much. Because extrinsic things don't mean a whole lot when intrinsically I feel satisfied and fulfilled. But if I don't have intrinsic fulfillment, extrinsic benefits will mean nothing. But if we have neither, that's the greatest losing combination you can have. So let's practice a project of speaking good words. Go to someone who has been a help and someone who has been a blessing, someone who has worked endless hours, and let that be a word of encouragement. Let that be a word of help to them.
Thank you for joining us for Building Great Leaders today. Dr. Les Olala speaking on The Happy Servant. This program is a ministry of Building Great Leaders, providing instruction, encouragement, and resources for Christian leaders, and is produced by Harvest Ministries on Guam. You can learn more at bgleaders.org, bgleaders.org. Join us again for more teaching from the Word of God next time on Building Great Leaders.